and welcome to Practice Preparedness with your host, Will Hemingway, coming to you live every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. on WNJC 1360, also streaming live on TuneIn, Radio Amity or whatever it is, and a couple of others. You can go to my website at practicepreparedness.com, because with that, you don't have to know any of those other things. It'll take you right there. Click on Listen Live. If you miss some of the show afterwards, you can go back, listen to rest in a couple hours. As I always post the shows in the archives under show notes, so join us there, practicepreparedness.com. Today, an interesting set of experiences over the past week that I had, but before we came on, I was enlightening the crew in the station to, something a little funny. Mr. Hanky, the Christmas poo, which apparently they didn't know of, but now they've been enlightened. They're completely fulfilled now. You can't be, totally rounded unless you know all about him. So, at least get the upbeat tone going in the station house before we get started. All week, this week, last week, I've been involved in repapering, going back and updating a lot of my certifications in the preparedness industry and an EMS side, and a couple of the things that I did are going to redo my instructor certification with the Red Cross for CPR, AED, and first aid. And it's really reminded me, I'd let them go several years back. I wasn't really using them every day. The knowledge was there. But it's really reminded me of a point that started me out on this course 25 some odd years ago, when I was training corporate personnel around the world at our facilities for the company that I worked with, and how it literally changes the way that you live. I always say, and I've told this story several times, that over the years, no matter how many thousands of investigations I've done, how many things I've recovered, how many criminals that I stopped, how many whatevers, the most important, valuable things in my perception that I ever did were things that made a real difference to the world and people in the world, that had nothing to do with money, a name tag, or recognition for that matter. And one that always has left a mark on me was an incident with a woman who I had interacted with, along with about 800, 900 other people in a very large group of managers when I trained management twice a year for one of the companies I ran, in risk management, in safety, security measures, and loss prevention. And one of the things that I would do to break it up would be that I would do a demonstration where I would teach them how to use a fire extinguisher. And I would always out somebody who was in there who'd be acting like I was boring them with stupidity because they knew everything. And I'd always have a little fun, and everyone else would be, because a lot of them would be equally annoyed by the know-it-all in the room who would interrupt and make it hard for them to hear. And I'd pull them up onto the stage in front of everyone and get them to make an idiot out of themselves when they'd try reading the instructions on the side of the fire extinguisher while the fire's burning. And it was a really viable means to teach a long-lasting lesson to them about how preparedness really works. And the key, speaking of preparedness, I just realized I did not plug my computer in. Isn't that nice? Do you see the plug back there? that experience would regularly teach, thank you. And that experience would regularly teach a large group of people a lasting lesson, because they didn't want to be the one called on next and make them look stupid also. So what would they do? This is how a lot of people learn lasting lessons. They get embarrassed, or they are in great fear of being embarrassed, and this motivates them to actually do something. Well, I'd prefer for you to not have to be embarrassed, but moreover, I'd prefer for you not to suffer, or someone close to you to suffer an even worse outcome, because you claim to be prepared, because you yap about being prepared, but you're not actually prepared. And a good example of it came up when I was in this class the other day, and I was struck by people who are well-educated, who have skills and time in a business where they actually encounter these types of situations on a regular basis, yet they really did not have the skill set or were not aware of the skills of what to do. When you work in a child care center, when you work in a school, these things happen all the time. If you're an athletic director, especially if you are a coach for, say, football or basketball or some, especially a strenuous sport, where, you know, you're going to actually have kids who are going to be pushing past their limit because they don't want to lose, because they don't want to be embarrassed, because they don't want to be beaten up or whatever by their peers. They will push past their limits. It happens every year, all the time. Some of them make the news, some of them don't, where the kids end up with embolisms, they have a heart attack, they have a stroke, even at 12 or 15 years old. It happens quite commonly. And now with the advent of things like Monster Energy drinks and Red Bull and all these things, where the kids are banging these things, cases and eight packs at a time, it's only getting worse with the guarana, which is one of the common primary stimulants in it that are linked to all kinds of cardiac arrest, cardiac problems, all kinds of problems with heart rate and unusual heart rate problems. It all comes through, and it's only making this a bigger problem. I would put to you the question that I put on the front end of the site for today's show. Are you really prepared? Are you sure? If you were somewhere where an incident occurs, are you ready to respond? Would you respond? Why would you not respond? When I was in the class the other day, I made a point, which is that the only way that you'll get a person, even a person who's gone to a class like that, who's certified now in first aid and AED and all that, they've been officially trained, does not mean that should they encounter that situation, even with someone they care about, that they will actually respond. Why is that? Because if they don't feel comfortable with it, even especially if it's someone they care about, they may be afraid to do it because they're afraid they'll make it worse, not better. The only way that you're going to respond and do something is if you're practiced. If you're not, the likelihood of a person within 3 months of the time that they've been there and they got their proud little certificate that they're certified to do CPR and AED, the likelihood that they're actually going to perform that task if they're presented with the need is very, very slim. EMS, EMTs, EMRs, they will probably do it because they're doing it on a regular basis. Even if you only show up to one run a month, the likelihood is it's forced you to keep in your mind fresh and review so you know what you're doing. If you don't work in the field, there are now ways that you can actually stay on it. For instance, if you become certified under Red Cross, when you are, during the two-year period that your certification is in force, you for free can go to their website, sign on, and use a sim where you do everything but touch an actual body. You're timed. They check the speed and the frequency of your compressions when you give CPR. They check the amount of time that you give a life-saving breath. They check to make sure that you remember to do the things in the right order. It's actually pretty cool. Of course, I was cursing it because I did it twice and it failed to give me my name on the certificate when I got done, but it still worked. And I will tell you this, that even though I was EMS and that I actually did those runs, I had forgotten some of that stuff. You could go back every month and spend 20, 30 minutes in one of those sims and refresh yourself and feel confident to know that you at least know the steps and that you've gotten them down so well that you won't feel like you can't do it. I hearken back to an experience that I had from a distance when I was in my mid-teens, when my grandfather, who I had just left a few weeks before visiting with my grandmother who lived in Florida, I had come back home. He had woken up at 7 a.m. on the dot sharp like he always did every morning to go do his daily routine that he was going to perform. He turned to my grandmother in her bed next to him and he turned blue. My grandmother had no skills. She had never trained. She barely got out of the house except with him. She was a homemaker her entire life. They were in their 70s, you know, so what are you gonna do? I'm sorry, in their 60s. This was a different era. She ran around in circles. She grabbed the phone. She screamed on the phone, got 911. The helicopter came in and landed across the street. It was too late. You have 3 minutes from the time that that person stops breathing until brain cells start dying. What would you do? Is there someone there who you're gonna leave to trust that to? What if it's your child? Most parents don't think about this. They think, oh, it's just gonna be me. Oh, well, it's on me, whatever. What if it's your child? What if they're choking? What if they're bleeding? What if they cut themselves? What if they did something stupid and cut themselves or seriously injured themselves that caused them to have a problem that's life-threatening? You have failed to be prepared. If you call yourself a prepared person, if you call yourself a survivalist or a prepper, and you haven't done these things, I'm sorry, you are not prepared. Because like I said in the commentary that I made on the front end of today's show's notes on the website at practicepreparedness.com, all these other things you yip-yap about RAW, the end, you know, without rule of law, Tetewaki, the end of the world as we know it, blah, blah. These things have happened once or twice in the last 200 years. This stuff happens hundreds of times a day in a nation with 330 million people. It could be your parents, it could be your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your wife, your husband, your kid. If you haven't taken the time to do it, shame on you. If you think you're prepared, you're not. And if everybody did it, it would be a better position for everyone to be in because someone will take the time to do it. If you do go to do that, understand that, for instance, in the state of New Jersey, believe it or not, in a state where you can be sued for everything, where they tax you for everything except your excrement, practically, and they'll do that one day when they figure out how, the fact of the matter is that we have some of the best Good Samaritan laws in the United States. If you follow some basic criteria, which you learn when you become trained, you will be protected from a lawsuit. Very few lawsuits are ever filed against a Good Samaritan. And if you have followed those, they'll blow it out before you spent your first few hours in court. That's just the way it works. The fact of the matter is, you may not even want to do it for another person, but if you can do it for a family member, this can be the difference. This will change their life, it will change your life, and keep it in a positive direction. You don't want to waste the time waiting. What is the average response time in the city for a police department to an emergency medical incident? Well, in Philadelphia, according to several research papers recently, it can vary from between 20 minutes and 48 minutes. If you have 3 minutes, where does that leave you? Dead. Brain damaged at best. If you have somebody come up 10 minutes in and go, ooh, I'll give them CPR, and it's a little too late, they'll be drinking out of a straw and, you know, and mumbling. That's not a good answer, especially if it's you. That really sucks. You don't want to be there. So remember, you can begin easy, but no matter what you do, if you don't do anything, you're still going to be not prepared. If you start today and do one thing now and one thing in a few months and one in another, after a while, you will have caught up and you'll be ahead of the curve. And you can bring others with you in your family, in your community, neighbors, whatever, so that you can help, because it is a matter of time. It's not if, it's when. And when you want to be able to actually do something. I've done what's now no longer, they won't refer to it as a Heimlich maneuver because there was a big lawsuit over the name and some copyright infringement. So now they refer to them as chest thrusts and back thrusts. But whatever you want to call it, in a choking incident, I've done it. I've done it several times. I did it once for a person in Old Country Buffet who was choking. And it's amazing how such a simple act can make such a difference. I talk to that person at least once a week for two, almost 3 years after the incident, when they were standing there choking, making faces, and their family was laughing because they thought they were joking. Nobody even said, are you all right? And I was watching going, what's that guy doing? And I went over and I was like, are you all right? Can you speak? And I ended up asking him if I could, and I gave him what then we referred to as a Heimlich maneuver. And I did it three or four times, and when I did it the one time, he, poof, and it came out, and that was that. And he started coughing, and then he threw up and all that nice stuff. But hey, he lived, you know, and it was no big shakes. It was simple, but no one, there were probably 150 people in that place, of which half of them stood there like they were watching some kind of a cartoon and did absolutely nothing. Nothing. And that's the sad event situation that we have. While we hear all this blather, especially during the election season, about, oh, caring for people and all that, really, what's more rudimentary than caring for your neighbor when they're dying in front of you? You know, especially when it's not something that involves bloodborne pathogen issues like a bleed, where you get into other things because people have phobias and are not trained and are not aware and they don't have the proper gear and all that. When a person's choking, you really don't have to worry about that. It's not going to impact you. I mean, the likelihood of you being impacted by that is nil. And nowadays, if you're proficient in CPR, you don't have to worry really about that. I carry a disposable barrier with me all the time. It's in a little pouch in my pocket. I also have, an adult and a child mask. So I have the next one up because I like the filter and the backflow valves and all that, but that's personal. And everyone makes fun of me for my bat belt and, you know, all that. But, the way I look at it is I already know I'm going to be the one, so I at least want to be the best prepared for whatever it is I'm going to do. Nowadays, when you go into most major places, like a chain restaurant or into a mall, there are AEDs everywhere. The most awesome part about an AED, if you don't know what it is, it's an automatic electronic defibrillator device, is they're built for a non-EMS, non-technical medical personnel, for a lay person to use. You follow the directions, you place the pads on them, on an adult, on the right chest and on the left side. You push the button, it starts up, it tells you what to do. It doesn't get much simpler than that. All clear, everybody clear. Then it says, it checks them, it sees what their heart rhythm is, it checks to see if they're breathing, it knows, and then it tells you, shock advised, all clear. You push the button for shock, they get shocked, and then you do CPR. This is the way it works. If you don't want to give them the breathing, you can still give them compressions. The likelihood of them surviving increases, according to statistics, by over 80%. And wait, while you're waiting, hopefully the 911 call goes out while you're doing that. This is what happens. You will save someone's life, and it may be someone close to you who will still be with you thanks to that. And this is what being prepared is really about. Because while we hear all these people talking about their guns and their toys and their gear and their tents and their this and that, when it comes right down to it, the likelihood they're ever going to unpack 2/3 of that and ever actually use it for real survival means is next to zero. But if you know these things, the likelihood that you will ever use them is probably very high. unless you are a wallflower, you don't speak to humans, and you live in a cave. Just the way it works. And by doing this, what it does is it will also provide you with a level of confidence that you are actually actively engaged in the world around you and in your survival, because while you're doing this, you will cause other people to want to be also actively engaged, because they may be the one to save you. Do you know, for instance, that if you're choking and no one's around or nobody's helping or they won't help, that you can actually throw yourself over a chair back and hit yourself right below? It's about halfway between the belly button and the bottom of your rib cage. And if you hit yourself hard enough on it a few times, you may dislodge what is choking you that way. I couldn't believe there were people that I spoke to the other day who actually work in places where you'll have to do this, who did not know that. And this is the problem, because we have disengaged from the world around us. You cannot be disengaged and be a prepper or be a survivalist or prepared or whatever it is you want to call yourself. It just is completely contradictory, and you need to realize that so that you actually work to become prepared. And a lot of these things go together. Years ago, I came to the realization that I was going to be a fireman against my mother's will, for reasons I will leave out, made it very, very difficult for me to do that. I had to do it surreptitiously because I had been friends with someone in high school who lived in a very high dollar neighborhood across the street from the one I grew up in Cherry Hill, in a $500,000 house in the 70s. And a fire had started in the house, and basically the father ran around in circles and ran screaming, panicking, because he didn't know what to do. And the kids ran around in circles screaming and panicking and fell down and succumbed to smoke inhalation, because they were trying to stay in the house because it kept them close, because it made them feel like they were fulfilling their responsibility to do something. Of course, it wasn't actually doing anything. Well, the mother burned to death in the bedroom. And it struck me so deeply. I was 15 going on 16. I had very few friends in high school because I was very introverted. I know you can't believe that. And I was extremely introverted. And the few friends I had were all known as the geeks. They were all the techies and whatnot. We were building computers with little solder on chips in the early 70s and playing with Commodore 64s and TRS-16s and whatnot, and building things in early electronics. And I was so stunned by it. I remember going to the funeral. I'm going to be 56 years old in November, and I can still remember it now. And I'm stunned by the recollection I have today. It struck me the other day when I was in this one class, and I thought to myself, my God, this is why I went to become a fireman. Because I swore that I was going to learn everything I could so that I would not run around in circles screaming, fall down on the ground, and go, oh God, I don't know what to do. I was like, yeah, not going to happen, not going to happen. By the time I was 18, I was through begin basic fire, advanced fire, AFFF airplane crash, foam truck, hazmat, you name it. By the time I hit 19, I had certs on everything. I was even trying to get my license to drive a fire truck by then. I was done. I was not going there. I was going to know everything I could know. I may not have known it all, but I at least knew I was not going to be running around in circles screaming. And that's really the thing. And you can do the same thing. I'm not saying maybe you're going to join the fire company, though it's not such a bad idea, you know, or the ambulance squad. You get to know your town. They get to know you. Something happens at your house, they're going to get there faster because they know who you are. And in this day and age, every little edge that you can have counts when it comes to life-saving and the ability to be able to take care of yourself, your loved ones, and by the way, your property. So the thing is, this is what comes from building community. It attaches you to those around you, them to you, and it opens doors and breaks down walls. Because in the end, if you plan to survive, whether it's a flood or a hurricane or whatever, you look at what's going on in Louisiana right now. Nobody give a rat's rear end right now if you're black, green, orange, green, yellow, pink, whatever. All you know is none of you have a house to go back to. None of you have food. None of you have any of your clothes. All your stuff is underwater or completely destroyed. You are all equal. And in the end, what happens is they come together. Unfortunately, I've been in these places during and after these type occurrences, and for some time after, there's an unbelievable, palpable change in the civility amongst people. And then they start listening to the outsiders who are telling them how the world really is, and they want scapegoats and boogeymen, and the next thing you know, then it's this person's fault, and I hate you again, and it all disappears. It's sad. When I was in New York City when the planes hit, and then I worked there for 4 months, 5 months after that, almost every day, it was shocking the difference in the humanity amongst people. I couldn't believe I was in the same place. The day it happened, I was sitting with the radio on while I was doing a surveillance, quietly in the background, listening on XM, listening to them blathering on about whatever thing it was they were yapping. Oh, I know what it was. They were arguing that they should force Toys R Us to remove G.I. Joe from the shelves because it was a symbol of violence. And I only remember this because 3 weeks later, when I walked in the front door into Toys R Us, there was an entire wall of G.I. Joes. Because the world's, and certainly the United States of America's mainline people, their populace, changed their perception of what was important. People who would have spit in your face were holding doors for you when you walked in with a box or whatever, who the day before would have kicked you in the face for all they cared. It was a stunning change. And then about 7 months later, it started to fall back to the old thing because they were getting pushed in the background by the endless blather that separates and divides us rather than brings us together and allows us to move ahead together to something greater. But what it did show was in that short period of time, what looked like it was a lost cause, New York City, one of the most disrespectful, horrendously horrible places to be because people were so self-centered and ignorant, were good, decent people interacting with other good, decent people in a common interest. It was a great, great experience. I was so thankful that I got to experience it because it really altered my opinion about how people react in a crisis. It was really amazing. And one of the things that I picked up from watching that was that when the dust was settling after the buildings fell, I had made it across into New Jersey because I knew it was about to get really bad. And I watched it on the news that night, and I was amazed that the people were walking around as the dust was floating in the air, and they weren't even covering their faces. Why? Because they had no idea. And this is goes to what I'm going to go to after we get over the break in a minute, is about having some base knowledge that you can apply. Because if you've got it in a book in your backpack and you're like, oh, I've got this good for a rainy day, it's too late. It's way too late. So we're going to go off to a break. I'm Will Hemingway, your host at Practice Preparedness. We'll be back in a minute.
Are you drowning in the cost from your home or business alarm system? Are you paying as much as $35 per month for a telephone line that the alarm system needs to signal for help? If you are not under contract or about to be, then you should call Integrity Protection Service at 856-861-0300. There are fully licensed and insured alarm companies serving the South Jersey and Philadelphia area. Integrity Protection Service can take over your alarm monitoring starting at $19.99 per month on a year-to-year agreement. If you want to up the ante on your security, you can have them install a cellular communicator for a one-time fee of $140 plus tax. With a cellular unit, you can dump your hardline telephone line, saving yourself from $20 to $40 per month. Did you know that 99% of burglar alarm systems never check in to assure their function? They only dial out to report a system failure or a security breach. A system with a cellular communicator checks in at least once every 15 minutes to alert the provider and you if you have been breached or are having a system failure. So, if you want to save money and increase your security, go to Integrity Protection Service. They have over 30 years of investigative and physical security protection experience to help you. No long-term contracts. Integrity Protection Service wants clients, not hostages. So call them today at 856-861-0300.
So, go to our website, practicepreparedness.com. And at the bottom, you'll find a form. You can fill it out and send it to us, and I will respond directly to you to help set up a training program for you. We can make a disaster plan. We can help you write your disaster plan for your family or for your business. We can help you set up disaster preparedness drills. We can teach you how to make your kit. We can help you design and lay out your program on staying and surviving in place or leaving your home to go to some place of safety to help yourself, your family, and those who are close to you and surround you. Don't wait. Don't put it off, because the disaster could simply be around the corner. So go to practicepreparedness.com, click on that form and go there. You can also join our groups that are listed on there. You'll see join our groups and training. There's a whole page set there to tell you all about our training opportunities, both meetup.com groups and others. So if you have a church group, an organization who's looking to train your members, you can contact us about that too, and we can put together a discount program for all of you. And you can do that as simply as filling out the form and clicking send, and we will get right back to you. All right, and we're back with Practice Preparedness. I am your host, Will Hemingway. As usual, you can go listen to us also at practicepreparedness.com. You listen either live, click on the Listen Live button, or you can listen to our past shows and this one in a few hours when I post it. You can go there too. So, anyhow, to continue on, as I was saying, so once you get past the idea of some of the most catastrophic things that can occur that you need to be ready for, you also need to be prepared with a good basis of some skill sets and some knowledge. I prefer to call it wisdom, because wisdom is knowledge tempered by reason put into action. So it's all fine and well to have a bunch of gibberish in your head, but it really doesn't mean squat if you've never tried it, you've never done it, because you won't even know whether it's right or not. One of the things that I was alluding to with doing the sim, for instance, with the CPR AED, is that the really awesome thing with that is all the timing is there, all the actions are there. You're just not physically doing it. In fact, when I was doing the sim, I was actually pushing. Like, there's a section in providing CPR where the first thing that you want to do if a person has lost consciousness is to assess their status. So when you kneel down next to them, you shout their name, or you shout to them and ask them if they're okay. If they don't respond, then you tap their shoulder briskly and you shout their name or ask them again if they can respond. This is to check their mental status. If they do not respond, you now know they're not conscious and you have implied consent, which is really critical when you come to the liability side of performing any kind of an action in a CPR AED / first aid situation, is to either obtain consent, or once you verify using standard means, which is simply that they are not capable of responding, then you have implied consent. Once you're there, it's really simple. There are a set of rules that you follow. You provide chest compressions, you provide breaths of life, and then you go back to the chest compressions. 32, 32. It's very simple. And if you are certified, do you know how to keep count to have the proper timing on them? If you don't, I'll tell you, it's really simple. One and two and three and four and five and so forth up. And when you get to 10, it's a long enough word that it's the proper amount of time for each one so that you do the between 110 and 120 compressions within a set period of time. So that is the correct timing. They use a metronome sometimes when they teach it. I find it to be much better to get used to what you would actually do in the field. You're not going to have a metronome. Don't practice with a metronome. You won't have one. If you have an AED, sometimes it may have a metronome in it. The point is, they're not going to die if you give them 32 in the time that you should have given them 30. But there's a certain set of mechanics that happen involved. When you're going through a sim like that, it will get you used to it. And when you're doing it in person in a hands-on class, skills class, you're learning something that is most crucial to learn, that has everything to do with every kind of a skill that you will ever use, certainly in a survival preparedness mode, which is something that's referred to as muscle memory. In another endeavor in which I've been involved over my lifetime, there was a massive amount of Old English ritual that I had to learn in a very specific order, that if you take it out of order, it loses its meaning, its efficacy, and its importance, because it's prescribed every year. They go over it and tweak it a little bit, or sometimes it's been the same for 200 years. But there's a story and a meaning that you get from it. If you change it, it screws it up. So you have to get it right. Well, for a person living in modern America and, you know, in the United States today, to speak somewhat Old English in a very structured language, in a very structured mindset about things that you may have just become aware of, it becomes very difficult to make this throw and get it right, especially when you're strained and stressed in front of a whole pile of mostly older people who will be present, who will all be waiting for you to screw it up and tell you 50 times from Sunday that you got it wrong. And a really great person who I'm friends with, he helped me when I was practicing one of my big pieces of ritual. And what he did for me was he stood me in front of a mirror and he told me to voice the words and look myself in the mirror and move my lips really weirdly so that I was exaggerating making my words, and practice the entire thing that way. So I found out that putting a little clip on the side of the mirror so that I didn't lose the blood out of my arm for doing this for half an hour, holding up the book, really worked out really well. I flipped the pages, I did this, and it worked out pretty well. And when I did my 20 whatever minute throw, it flowed so well. When I got to the end of it, I was convinced I had forgotten something. They had all fallen asleep and nobody noticed because it went so easily. And it was because the few times that I started to mess it up, my brain said, nope, nope, that's not right, because I had muscle memory. And the muscle memory said, wait, you missed something. I stopped and I stepped back and I was like, sorry, okay. And then I just went right forward. And after the first time I did it, I didn't even say anything. I just said the correct word and I kept going. No one even noticed. I was in shock. Because I know they must have been like, wait, we're supposed to give them a hard time because this is our role, is, you know, telling you we old guys know all this and you don't know crap and you screwed it all up, and then pat you on the back later and say, one day you'll be one of us and so forth. And they're all great guys and all, but when you want to get it right, especially if you're someone like me who's unfortunately a perfectionist, I'll bash my head on the wall because I got it wrong, so I don't want to get it wrong. And I learned a lot from this. And it reminded me of another experience, which I think is very appropriate for this conversation. I grew up, thanks to my mother, giving up a lot of potential in her career, going and working as a teacher and then becoming the department head for a private school where at the time people were getting paid five times what she got paid for her to work there at Haddonfield Friends School in Haddonfield in New Jersey in the 60s and they took it out of her salary to pay for me to go to school there. And my next younger brother went for a little while, and then things changed, and she pulled him out, and I had gone on into public school and the high school, and things changed, and she ended up taking a public school job. And it's interesting because here's reality. My mother, up until very recently, believed that the biggest mistake she ever made was putting me through Haddonfield Friends School and private school because it ruined my life. Interestingly enough, I would proffer that the reason I am the way I am, because I have this set of values and core values that I have, came directly as a result of what my mother suffered for to put me through that school where I got a real education when it actually mattered. Because when you hit 5 years old, six at the max nowadays, you have lost 99% of the control of what is going into those little minds of mush that you call your kids. They have now been handed over to the most unbelievably flawed system that there is, the United States public education system. The public school has become a train wreck, and I differ with most people in the fact, because I had two educators in my family who worked really hard at it. There are some who don't work hard at it at all and just love the paycheck and 2.5 months off. But for the most part, if you're going to put up with that crap after the first couple of years, you basically have some desire to actually do something good, because it's not worth it otherwise. It's got to be self-fulfilling. And I have to tell you, it is not the teachers that are the problem. When the parent doesn't do the homework with them when they get home, when the parent doesn't say, "What are you doing outside? Where's your homework? I want to see it." It doesn't matter how good that teacher is, they're not going to learn anything. And when they fail, it is not the teacher's fault. It is the kid and the family's fault. Because I'll tell you what, I spent many a summer inside while all the kids on the block were outside. Well, my mother made me read a book a day because I had gotten bad grades in something, because my bad grade was I got a 90, you know. And the reality of it is that I'll take that any day in retrospect over what I see these people I know do with their kids, where they're like, "Oh, well, the school didn't this." The school, I'm sorry, it's not the school's job. And it is certainly not the school's job, nor their capability to teach your children ethics and morals. And if you can't, then you better find somebody in your family who can. And you're not listening to the show anyway, because you'll hate me in 2 seconds, because I have expectations. And people who don't have ethics and morals have no expectations. That's why they have no expectations. The fact of the matter is, you only get what you give. And if you didn't put the effort into it, you can't expect to get anything out of it. And it goes to the same thing right back around. Went well, FEMA didn't give me this, FEMA didn't give me that. I live in a house that's at 7-10 feet below sea level. It floods every 4 years. It's not fair. They didn't bring me, you know, filet mignon and whatnot. I want this, I want that. Sorry, they're bringing you enough to keep you alive so you get up and go and do something for yourself and can get back on your feet. It is unrealistic, but this is the world we live in, where you get arrested for murder and you go in when you used to live in a house that had holes in the wall and drippy ceilings. And now you go in and you have 3 square meals, a full workout gym, a law library, free education, and, you know, and satellite TV with 350 channels. I want that. I drop cable because I'm pissed off and don't want to pay the bill because I feel like I'm being raped every month when I pay the bill. This is reality. And this is the world we live in, a wussified world where everybody's soft and everybody has gotten to the point where they want everyone else to do for them. If you want to call yourself prepared and you have stayed on this long on this show today, then you probably are or want to be, then I implore you to take the next step and actively engage. Not just talk about it. Don't go buy toys. Join a group. Join, if you're listening and you're in a local area, join my meetup.com groups. Come out. We have conversations. We talk. I present. We go through ideas, and then we share roundtable with what people are doing and what their experiences are and what helped them. We're building a community of people who are actively engaged and interested so that those who are not, they're not our problem. Those who are, we'll have people to turn to who we can work together to make things better for us. And you know, it's infectious. Because when you're not panicking and running around saying the sky's falling and oh, disaster in Tetewaki's happening tomorrow, but they see you change a guy's tire across a street or whatever and go, wow, how did you even know to do that? And you explain in an intelligent way, thoughtful way. They say, well, I want to learn that. Suddenly they start to engage and we all win from this. This is what the country used to be about. It used to be about people who did things. And you know, when you come right down to it, I was really laughing because I was reading an article and I thought it quite laughable because they were saying in the article that, you know, this whole preparedness only started with FEMA right after Katrina. What? Wait, what? Like, my argument is, for years, the fact of the matter is that when you really come down to it, I have an article on practicesurvival.com and it's entitled, Your Grandparents Were Preppers. Why is it that they had a root cellar? My grandparents lived in Haddonfield. They didn't have a farm. They would go to the farm and buy things, bring it back. My grandmother would set it out. Myself and my younger brothers would be free slave labor over the weekend. We'd snap peas and break green beans and whatever else and scrub and clean whatever it was she set on the table before we were allowed to go play. And she can. And those cans, which were in mostly ball jars, would end up where? In her basement with a dirt floor on wooden shelves that my grandfather constructed all around the outside of the basement walls where it was cool, where it stayed 55 degrees. They didn't have air conditioner. We didn't even get an air conditioner until the mid-70s, you know. And they didn't have a window. None of that even really existed then. And they put it up, quote unquote, in the basement, and all winter long they'd have fresh vegetables from the farm that were canned in the basement that didn't have nitrates and BPAs and all this crap that made you sick and stupid and grow boobs and whatever other silly stuff that happens, like from BPA and these other endocrine replacements that are in all the food and all these hormonal mess that's going to screw up your kids and you and have long-term effects. And I was thumbing through some of the stuff I had, and I was reading an article, one of the notes that I had written about a book called True Preparedness. And I had to laugh because it was written by a guy who was born in 1855, died in 1945. It was published in 1916. His name was Charles William Dabney. And his basic thing was about ethics and preparedness, and how it played into the fabric of what made a strong society. And this is something we have lost. Well, we've become the me, I want it now, and in the business side, it's just in time where they deliver and they run out and they deliver again, so they only stock 3 days of food and where you call on the phone and say, hey honey, what do you want for dinner? I'm gonna stop at Wawa. First of all, what? I'm going to Heritage for dinner. What the hell are you going to eat from Heritage for dinner? Oh, we're going to have hoagies tonight. Really? Like, I would have been shot. But from the time I was 12 years old on, my mother demanded, it was my job that I cook dinner. And it was not making Swanson dinners out at TV dinners in the oven. We didn't even have microwaves; they didn't exist yet. Radar range, whatever, didn't happen yet. And I would make from scratch with the cookbook out, and the kitchen would look like it had had a tornado in it, and I'd be stuck in there till 9 o'clock washing dishes and pans and pots because I never did figure out how you make all that stuff and how it's made and then it appears and there's no dirty things. And the reason, of course, is because when I used to watch The French Chef and Julia Childs, I didn't know that in the background they had like 12 little minions run around that would grab the pot and run away, and suddenly a clean one appeared, and clean dishes appeared, and clean silverware appeared, because they were all doing this in the background. I'm going, I can't do this. I'm not good at this. Why is this? I don't see them have to do this. Well, that's why. And you know this when you do things. Practice, that's what happens. And in True Preparedness, he talks about all of what it takes to become prepared in 1916. And this is something that is the core of what makes a strong society. What happens? You have a nuclear family unit. If you don't have a family, your friends and neighbors come together and do things together. They go on the weekend and can, or they do whatever, and they make a community garden so they can share responsibilities, and it's not all on one person. This is what happens, and each one of these things helps to build forward. Getting back to the 911 example, how do you get to a place where there's dust all around and you're coughing up black and you're blowing your nose and it's black and you can't see because your eyes are burning and there's dust, that you don't think to yourself, maybe I should cover my face. Okay, I don't have anything. Let me open my shirt and pull it up over my nose. How do you not do these things on day three? Day three. And the EPA, and I'll never forget the head of the EPA at that time, one of my least favorite ex-governors of New Jersey, Christy Whitman, came in, and they came in with the Nest people to check for radiation, and they posted signs on the poles after they told everyone, you don't need anything but one of those little paper masks with the little rubber bands around your ears. And they posted the next day a list of 179 carcinogenic materials that were airborne and in dust form, and that you should protect yourself from it, and gave no any kind of training or any information whatsoever. I mean, they could have put a picture up saying, use a face mask, use a respirator, or go buy them here, we're giving them out, whatever. And what did you end up with? The people who work down there and around, and by the way, the least mentioned will be the ones who will get the least help, were not the responders who were there, who mostly knew that you had to do something. It was the people who still went back to work there, who were walking all around there. I have pictures from right next door where I was working on the 12th. And all the military garb and the SWAT personnel with the attack dogs who were sniffing people for bombs all around the area, who were walking about with no face cover, with no mask, with no breathing apparatus, with no nothing, and everyone in their suits with the bottoms of their leg up to their knees, all white. We must learn from the past to protect from the future. Even if no 911 ever happens, you should know what to do when you encounter these things so you have some basic ideas. I had a real breathing apparatus and real goggles and everything with me so that I was prepared a year before. They used to make fun of me. They called my bat belt and they with my gear on my belt, and they made fun of me because in my briefcase I had one of those yellow construction rubber rain suits and this, you know, and duct tape so I could tape it up to keep it from going in, because you don't know whether it's toxic or if it's going to burn you or whatever. And I always wore boots that I had polished to a mirror shine so I could not have to be in wingtips so I could move. They used to make fun of me until the day after 911, and then everybody thought it was really cool. Well, why do you have to wait? Because it's function. form over function has become something I've become really stuck on over the past few days, because I'm astonished at how people will waste so much time on form and make things so pretty, and they fail, but it's okay because it looked pretty. And, you know, I was somewhere the other day, and the person was in an office. They have a job to type. 90% of what they do is typing on the computer, and they have those acrylic nails done, and they're like an inch long, and they're tick, 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 tacking and complaining because they're hitting the wrong keys. What? This is simple stuff. And this is preparedness to survive your day at work so you have a paycheck at the end of the week. This is where many people are. This is why, if you're not careful about how you go about working to become prepared, and you vocalize it to other people as you're amazed at what you're learning, you will get pushback from them because they're disconnected from reality. Be prepared for that. If you're new to this, recognize the fact that sometimes sharing what you know may not be the best idea, but they will pick up on and learn by example, by watching you do things as it vets out and shows. So as we wind down the show today, I want to kind of put a cap on this and put it in perspective. The point being, whether it's talking about CPR capabilities and choking and first aid, or it's talking about prepared for disaster or a flat tire or a breakdown on the highway or the power out from a storm, whatever it is, all of these things start with the first step. And once you have these steps and you start to build them and things happen and you use them and you find that they didn't quite work the way you wanted, you can tweak them and you get better at it and it becomes habit and you won't think about it. It will not consume your time. It just becomes part of what you do and who you are and how you live. And I heard someone say something on a YouTube, I think it was last week that I was watching, and it resounded with me because it's almost the same as something you've heard me say before. I kind of like their version a little better, I think, the way they had put it, but it was basically, don't look at people who say they're someone you should listen to and listen to them because they tell you this is what they are. Look at how they live. People make fun of me because when they look at my Jeep, someone really insulted me a couple years ago and told me that they looked at my truck and they thought that I was homeless. Since then, I've been very careful to make sure that everything is in very clear order. So even though it was in order for me, for them it wasn't, because they were anal retentive. And probably nothing I do would have fixed that. But I now look at it and laugh because I realize that really they were the one who asked me for help because they weren't prepared. It's relative. When I used to go wheeling a lot with a group, they had the bigger trucks and the fancier things with the more expensive toys. And at the end of the day, or in the middle of the day, who was the one who had the, oh, that truck over there? Go ask him. Who was the one who was winching them out of the hole? And who was the one who was pulling spare spark plugs out of the back of my truck and giving it to them? That was me. This is the difference between if you live it or you talk about it. That's the difference. And I would leave you with that thought, that that's why I always end the show every day telling you there is no disaster when you're prepared. And the most common disasters happen every day all around you, and no one's ever going to write a news story about it, because that's what life's about. It's what you make of it because of how prepared you are. Until next week, I am Will Hemingway. This is Practice Preparedness. Visit us on the web at practicepreparedness.com. Be safe, be prepared. We're out of here.